Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Skip. What are you drinking tonight?
Caldera's Lawnmower Lager, man. Lawnmower man. A crisp summertime lager with a flavor of grass clippings.
Oh, yeah. I love that grass.
I thought that's what I smelled when I first took a little whiff of this.
Brewed and canned by Caldera Brewing Company, Ashland, Oregon, USA.
I've been there before.
I really appreciate that on the side of the can, it specifically calls out, contains barley.
I like mountain water, you know, mountain water and yeast.
I believe this was the first brewery in Oregon to put IPAs into a 12-ounce can.
Oh, really?
Yeah, their idea was that you could go out on a boat trip and keep it in the water. And
that's smart. That's what I always did when I was fishing.
Yeah, our drink theme today was supposed to be summer ales or summer your favorite summer beverages.
Yeah.
And so we're starting off with the Lawnmower Lager. And so far, that's pretty tasty. It doesn't taste like
there's
grass.
There's no grass.
It tastes quite, I don't know. It tastes like beer, but
there's
shitty
grass
beer.
Clippings on the can. I'm so confused.
It's lightly hopped for a Pacific Northwest beer. And it has a very smooth start with just a little bit of bite before it ends on your palate. It's great for the summer because moderately low alcohol.
Yeah, 3.9% is pretty down there for any beer made in Oregon.
I could probably drink like 10 of these.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And be fine. And be fine. Absolutely.
And that's what makes it a great summertime beer. You know, it's the afternoon. You're out fishing. You're out biking.
You're
out motorcycling.
Well, speaking of biking, you're listening to another episode of Bikers, Dice, and Bars recorded here in Portland, Oregon. It is July 19th. As usual, I am NPC.
Just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And we are joined today by a very special guest.
Skip Von Kusky, a.k.a. Chillotronic.
And Skip, if you've been listening thus far, even thus far into this episode, you've already heard Skip singing. He does the intro music and the outro music to our episode.
Yay, Skip.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
You again. Thank you.
We've been talking about getting you on here for quite a while. Well, pretty much since Xander mentioned, I know this guy who can do music.
Who can make an awesome theme song, I'm pretty sure.
And
you did.
Well, thank you. I just took the text that you sent describing the show and turned it into a song.
well done. Yeah.
Thank you. We
got to talk some more about dive bars, and I think we're going to do that today. But before we do that, we have our first ever iTunes review, and it's a very glowing one. We actually kick off our reviews on Bikers, Dice, and Bars on iTunes with a 5-star review from a listener.
Ooh.
Who goes by the name of Gun Street Girl. Gun Street Girl has to say, I'm not saying this podcast is a deeply profound look into the human condition on par with Hemingway or Kerouac, but I'm not saying it isn't. Interesting topics, very funny and enjoyable. I'm a big fan of the old Portland bar talk. It feels a bit like time travel to hear about favorite old haunts that I forgot existed. Thank you, Gun Street Girl. We're looking forward to talking about more of those haunts.
We'll do it today.
Yeah, and if you ever hit us up when we're doing a live thing from a bar, we owe you a drink.
Absolutely.
Thanks again. All right, let's take it to the road.
So, Skip, how'd you come by cycling?
Well, I was given a small bike with solid tires on the dirt road I lived on when I was a small child. And it took me a long time to figure out how to ride it, but I took to it eventually, like a fish to tar sands. And then I quickly Got myself a 10-speed at the age of 10 that allowed me to ride on those dirt roads, even though it was more of a street bike. But the bike that I currently ride used to belong to none other than Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
What?
And is an orange Sears Roebuck
bike. Oh, yeah.
That I bought from you at a yard sale when we shared a house together.
I never knew Sears Roebuck made branded bikes.
Yeah. That was like the weird little gear shifts on the front, right?
Yeah, with the banana handlebars.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
It was kind of broken down when I bought it from you, but I brought it to a friend who actually went into a store and found orange cork tape. Whoa. To do the handlebars up in.
That's awesome.
And he made it really sweet. And then I started riding it and I realized I hate those banana handlebars. especially with the brakes on the banana. I had one when I was much younger that had a secondary set of brakes that were on the flat part of the bars that attached to the hand brakes. I miss those secondary brakes that I don't have to like lean down into a racing position in order to brake the bike. Well, that's really the end of the story. Is I have Xander's old bike and he probably wasn't aware of that until this moment.
I don't think I was that you still had that bike. That's awesome.
I actually came back to the house when everybody had to move out to collect it from the basement.
Oh, I mean, that probably means that my electric bass and amp are probably gone from there. And
that's sad.
That's sad.
Where was this?
13th and Tillamook.
Yeah. Oh. I lived on 13th a lot of my life.
Oh, yeah. On like the second floor, that tiny place that we used to play poker.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
I live next door.
Oh.
Apartment D.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a tiny little place.
Yeah.
But we all fit in there.
Somehow. I used to have people, like six of us over at a time to play poker. I don't know how that worked, but it was great.
So ever play around with anything with a motor?
I used to borrow a friend's Honda Spree.
Ooh.
To pick up party favors when I was in college. And I thought, this is a great thing. How amazing is it to be able to motorize and get across town
and this carry quickly? All those sparklers and party hats?
Yes,
I know,
right? Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Our Matthew, when he was on for the special crossover episode, he was talking about his Honda Spree and how he loved it.
Yes.
I troll the Facebook marketplace for mopeds all the time. I have good friends who are who have motorbikes, and like my probably my best friend had a 1980 Honda Goldwing for the longest time, and then he finally got a degree in X-ray and made enough money. He's got a Triumph Triple now and a Suzuki that's massive, but for longer tours.
Why'd he downgrade to the Triumph?
Well, I think he just liked the power of it for shorter rides.
Fair enough.
Unfortunately, I never got an endorsement or learned to ride motorcycles, but I have enjoyed riding on the back of them over years.
If you're ever interested in getting back into a Honda Spree, I may be able to get you one.
Now we're talking.
We'll talk off layer.
Or on another episode.
And if he doesn't take it, I'm quite positive Poppy will take you up on that.
You think she'd go for a spree?
The scooters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, did you have a topic planned today, Jacob?
Yeah. It's summer. We're drinking summertime beer. It's time for kicking back, fishing, barbecues, road trips. What goes well with all of this? Music.
Yeah.
And we happen to have a guest star who happens to be something of a star when it comes to music. I wanted to talk about songs about biking. Bicycling, motorcycling, and ones that stick with us. You know, Nathaniel and I, when we were getting everything set up, we're talking about it. And there's, you know, at first, neither of us could think of one. And then it just started coming and coming and coming. Everything from David Allan Coe's Flathead to Bon Jovi's
Wanted Dead or Alive.
On a steel horse.
On a steel horse I ride.
And I wanted to talk, I just wanted to pick people's brains on great songs about biking, bicycling, or motorcycling.
What's your favorite, Xander?
Well, the only one that comes immediately to mind would be that amazing song by Queen.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I don't know how you... I mean, it's just such a great song. And then, of course, you know, whenever you have a solo that's done by little bike bells is pretty incredible. And I will say that one of my favorite covers of that was by Asha and the Bison Rouge. Did a phenomenal cover of that song.
It's true. I remember that well. My personal favorite is... early Pink Floyd, Bike by Sid Barrett. I've got a bike. You can ride it if you like. It's got a basket, a bell that rings, and things to make it look good. I'd give it to you if I could, but I borrowed it.
What album is that on?
Geez, I do believe it's Piper at the Gates of Dawn, but I'm...
Oh, my.
It's been a long time since I pulled out the
album.
That's
their first album, right?
It was on Relics, was a collection of early Pink Floyd songs.
How about you, NPC?
The first one that really comes to mind for me is one of my favorite songs by Chibo Motto, and it's called Sci-Fi Wasabi, and it is a song about her just riding her bicycle through the city. It's a catchy little beat.
When it comes to motorcycles, the absolute first one that comes to mind for me is Born to Be Wild. It just... Classic. Sounds that way. It sounds like you're kicking it up and getting ready to rev the engine.
Once I start thinking about it, a whole bunch come to mind. The one that first came to mind was Arlo Guthrie. He did several songs about motorcycles, including the motorcycle song.
Oh, I don't want a pickle.
The one that my heart thinks of each and every time I get on the road and I'm just cruising down a back road at an easy pace is 1952 Vincent Black Lightning by Richard Thompson.
I just saw you pull that up and I didn't know why I didn't think of that. That is a great, great damn song.
I couldn't remember the year, but I have actually performed that song a number of times with artists that knew all the words, and it just always just makes my heart a little sad.
So at the Portland Motorcycle Film Festival 2 years ago, one of the shorts was an animation version of that song that in the row I was sitting in when that was playing, there were people openly weeping to that song because, I mean, first of all, Richard Thompson's an amazing performer to begin with. And
yes,
that song
I've seen him.
Is... just gets you right in the feels.
I honestly don't know this song.
Oh, well, we'll get it to
we'll
you.
We'll play it for you at the break.
Okay, I'm down.
It's licensed music, folks. We'd share otherwise. Beyond that, you know, I don't know what it is. When I went and started doing a little bit of research for this, I found that there were, on an easy survey, three times the numbers of songs with motorcycle in the lyrics compared to car.
Really?
That's hard to believe.
That blew me away.
Well, I mean, I think when you think of the romanticism of a motorbike over a car, I think it's almost no question.
Right.
And I also think when you consider how long music has been around, bicycles have been around for a very long time.
Right.
So they've kind of had an edge up on the length of music being performed and written about a mode of transportation. But I also just thought of another great song that I actually DJ. I mean, I know I kind of got caught off track. I was like, I don't know. I know some. Love and Rockets.
Oh.
Motorcycle.
Yep.
Great. I have it on vinyl as a 12-inch single. It's a great, great dance song.
Yeah, I saw them do that one live.
Ooh. Well, I saw Richard Thompson do Black Lightning live.
I am envious.
But that's a good dance hit. I'll probably play it at your wedding because it's a good one.
And okay.
I have no choice.
You should just collect all of this music and play it at my wedding.
Okay. That sounds like a good idea.
I don't know who the original writer of it was, but one of the songs that sticks with me on the bicycle front dates back to practically the birth of the bicycle, and it's called Velocimania.
It's a good name.
Well, it's Velocimania was the period during the Victorian age when Velocimania was a thing in England. Going faster, and these velocimaniacs, which were young sporting lads, who got on their velocipedes and pedaled down the road at a high rate of speed without wary a concern for anyone in their path. And it's
rapscallions and ne'er-do-wells.
And it's a song about the Velocimania craze and all of the social ills that it brings brings out in people. But it's sung from the point of view of very tongue-in-cheek, where it should, you can tell that it's a bunch of lads singing this song going, and we don't care. I'll pull the lyrics up and send it to you. It's great.
The ancestors of the Zoo Bombers.
Oh, yes.
The original hipsters.
So to all the Zoo Bombers out there, that's a challenge. We want to see a Zoo Bomb in spats.
And then engage in a nice round of fisticuffs with anybody who dares to affront upon you.
Yes, yes, and so much yes. I want, basically, I just want the Tweed Ride to be mixed with the Zoo Bombs and then have it be a good old-fashioned brawl at the end.
I'm sorry, the what ride?
The Tweed Ride.
I have never heard of this. Maybe our listeners haven't either. You should tell us about it.
I believe the Tweed Ride is part of Pedalpalooza, which has just ended, but it might be later. I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that it is a bicycle ride that is intended for, if you have antique bicycles, to come out and wear them, dressed in your finest tweed.
Ooh. Oh, tweed.
So I'm assuming you'd usually ride at the front of this event.
I have actually never been to this event because it's just something that I do anyways, as I'm showing off today.
Yes, you are quite dapper today, sir.
It makes me think that there must be at least 142 characters at the Tweed. Because I misheard you at the front of the conversation. The Tweet Ride.
Well, it actually grew in the last few years. They're up to 280 now.
Oh, nice.
Lord have mercy.
And then there is the motorcycle version of the same event, the Distinguished Gentleman's Ride, which is nowadays an international event, originally started in Australia and goes in Russia, multiple places in Europe, and all over the United States. It is a ride that's held over was a 1 week period. I think it's a 2 week period now at all of the different locations. It is where people come out with preferably vintage motorcycles, dressed as the distinguished gentle person they are.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is a fundraiser for prostate cancer research.
Huh, cool.
I want an old motorcycle now.
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds great.
Speaking of modes of transportation, Xander, how's that commute to work going for you?
You know, there's nothing quite like biking an hour and 10 to work, working for 8 to 12 hours, and then biking an hour and 10 back, 14 miles every direction. So 28 miles round trip is my current commute to my current job. And there was definitely a 7 day period in which I racked up over 200 miles in 7 days of just biking to work. And, you know, when you calculate it, 5 days a week, 2 hours and 20 minutes every day of just biking, it's basically like adding a whole extra day of work. That is nothing but on your bicycle after you stand on your feet all day and serve drinks to people. So, but I've noticed some very interesting things with the commute because I basically start in inner Southeast Portland. I go all the way through Portland. I go through Gresham. I go through Fairview and I end up in Troutdale. So I cross through a bunch of towns and I've had a lot of interesting observations along the way.
Have you ever considered taking the max, maybe like halfway? Saving some time.
I have, but I also looked up from where I live. I looked up on the Google Transit map how long it would take for me to go and take public transit from where I live to where I work versus biking. And it said biking should take you an hour and 12. Public transit should take you an hour and 15.
What?
To which I said, okay, I guess I'm biking.
How far away is Edgefield from the nearest MAX station?
I believe the closest one is probably the one at, it goes to downtown Gresham, which I think there's massive amounts of hills between there and...
There are.
So I think the smart move would be to take the one from Lloyd Center to the 162nd MAX stop.
Mm. Probably.
But you still have to wait for them, and then you still have to bike from there. But I've kind of considered it, but I also feel like I'm saving a lot of money and getting lots of good exercise by biking and catching up on fantastic podcasts such as this one.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I mean, I really have just been plowing through podcasts the entire time. But interesting things that I've observed is once you get past 82nd, this is where actual diversity lives in this city.
Yes.
it's been fascinating and really enlightening. Because basically, if you want good ethnic food, go past 182nd and eastbound. You'll find good food out there. Also interesting is the massive amounts of roadkill I've seen, including some very fresh ones. And I don't really see that really in the inner parts of Portland, but I definitely see that in the outer parts of Portland and going into the suburbs there.
Xander, I'm glad to hear that it's working out for you. Do you have any planned changes to your commute? Or are you going to try and stick it through for a while?
I am going to stick it through at least through the summer. My only possible change might come if we get some 100 plus degree days and I have to bike in the heat of it. However, my boss at work has been nice enough to say, yeah, if you come to work early and you need to shower, we will let you shower. So,
oh, that's right. It is Edgefield. They have showers.
They have lots of showers there. Lots of them. So they said if it's really hot and I get really sweaty on the ride, that they'll let me just shower, which is nice. I will just have to leave early to make sure I have time for that. When it comes to the wintertime or possibly ice on the road, that's when I might be changing up my routine a bit, just because it's one thing to bike that long or to bike in those awful weather conditions for, say, 15, 20 minutes. It's a whole different animal when you're talking about an hour and 10, especially when you get out to the very mouth of the Columbia River Gorge, yeah, where weather can change dramatically. So,
seriously.
Yeah.
I think there is a Halsey bus that goes all the way up there.
Yeah, I have to find it. Like I said, the weather's nice, so I haven't looked that hard into it yet. But like I said, when the weather starts to change, I might change my own tune a little bit. But then it's always a matter of getting back, because I would still be getting off work at, you know, midnight, 1, 2 a.m.
Well, good luck, Xander. Keep on biking. Hold true. Hold steady.
I will.
And thanks, Edgefield, for allowing our host to be clean.
Appreciate it.
And now let's take this to the gaming table, or console, if you will. But first, speaking of McMinimins...
late.
Xander has brought the second beer of the evening, which is McMinimins Ruby in a can.
Tall boy at that.
Ruby, my second favorite McMinimins beer.
Yeah, so the Ruby's another delicious, light, summer drinking beer made with copious amounts of raspberries that somehow manages to hold the essence of the raspberry flavor without being incredibly sweet, which is why I can't really drink Frambois anymore.
You know, with the amount of Ruby that McMinimins makes and sells every year, I'm surprised there hasn't been like a raspberry genocide.
Shortage of raspberries. Yeah.
They do grow a lot of them out at Edgefield, though. But I'm sure that's not where they get all of them.
Yeah, it's probably not.
Couldn't possibly.
That's just for show.
Look at all these berries that you're
Those not. Are the captive raspberries. Now, Skip had suggested a topic of old school gaming, like Atari and whatnot. And I think that's a fantastic idea. So that's what we're going to do today. Who here grew up with an Atari?
Anybody? I did.
Yeah. Or in television or a Coleco or a Commodore?
I did not.
Oh, I loved playing in television at my friend's house. And ColecoVision was certainly just felt like a little bit better than either of them, but it came a little bit later. I'm actually celebrating a milestone birthday, my golden jubilee, on August 1st. So my first introduction to video games was going to Sears with my family on a given weeknight and waiting in line to play Pong
at the
Magnavox home gaming system that they sold through Sears. And it was... there was no written rules, but everybody would line up and you would get to play Pong until you lost. So,
wow.
It was like pool, but like for the kids. I'm certain there were a few teenagers that were like excellent players that just
Pong bullied. Sharks.
Yeah, Pong sharks.
Were you, you know, taking secret bets on how long you can make it? Were there wagers? Were there?
No, but I have a distinct memory of like holding the Pong game for several matches, which did not happen the first dozen times I did it.
Now, did Pong have a scoring system? Like, did it allow you to track scores?
This is the early part of my childhood. I do believe that. We may have done it in our head, but I actually believe there was a graphic up in the corner that when the pong ball went past your paddle, the other guy got a point, or vice versa.
But I'm assuming it didn't have like a saved scoring system, like high score. I think Asteroids might, or maybe Asteroids or one of the arcade games might have been the first one that actually had saving the high score.
Yeah, I know Asteroids did. I spent a lot of time in arcades as a kid because the home games just were not anywhere close. And Asteroids did. I don't think Space Invaders kept scores.
The history of saved high scores dates back to pinball machines, back when they used to run on rotors for the score.
Oh, yeah.
Flip dials. You couldn't put your initials in, obviously, but if you got the new high score, it racked up a set of dials at the top of the machine.
Oh.
And that's where that dates back to. But I think you're right that Asteroids might have been the first one with the high score screen.
That allowed you to put in your initials and made it, turned it into a new way to gamify the game.
Right.
So, Skip, how long did you have to wait in line to play Pong on these evenings at Sears?
Oh, geez, really? Anywhere from, sometimes you wouldn't even get up to the machine because there would literally be a line of kids just waiting to check it out in the electronics department. But usually somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes.
So they were open late into the evening?
I'm sure they were open until 9, but usually, you know, our family would get there somewhere between 6 and 7. But at least my parents always knew where to find me.
You know? No, it was the same. Like, for me, it wasn't Pong, but I remember whenever my mom would take me and my sister to the mall, I would always end up in, it was one of the department stores. I want to say it was Penny's. So the Penny's or Sears. I think it was Penny's. And in the boys' clothing section, they had a small cabinet that sold Nintendo games. This is the original Nintendo Entertainment System. And I would go and they had a single Nintendo and you could play this, like, I think at the time it was like Rad Racer or something. I got really good at Rad Racer because she would go shopping and I would just be right there playing the whole time.
I remember I was in college when the NES came out, or Super Nintendo, I'm not sure which, but the people that I would go to for party favors would often rent a machine for the weekend and games from the local video store that had a game section. And it was, and I remember thinking, man, graphics have gotten so good. How could they even get better than this? You know,
they're 16-bit.
I remember there was a great scene from that 70s show where Kelso, I forget who the other character is, but they're playing Pong and they're so mesmerized by it. And they say the exact same thing as you're playing Pong. They just go, how can this possibly get better? And it was such a great scene. And you're like, yeah.
Yep.
So I had an Intellivision when I was a kid. It was a magical machine. We had 50, I think, games for it. We had a lot of games for this thing. It was my dad's. Now, my dad passed when I was 4, and my earliest memories are of him being alive and waking me up in the middle of the night as a little kid so I could go and sit with him and play a game that he called Space Turkeys, which is Space Invaders. We would sit and we would play Space Turkeys for hours, and it was the greatest thing ever. So my dad, at the age of like 3, addicted me to video games.
That's fantastic.
But we also had the Dungeons & Dragons game, which almost had nothing at all to do with Dungeons & Dragons, and a whole lot of other things. Lock and Key. Was it Lock and Chase, maybe? I don't remember. Burger Time.
Oh, Burger Time.
Oh, man. So many freaking games. Poker. I played the freaking poker game. My mom was like, you shouldn't be playing that. It's like, whatever, Mom.
When Atari came out, like many 70s kids, I probably guilted my mom into buying it for me because divorced parents.
Yeah.
It was like $200 for the console, and which is in 70s money was like
a grand,
a Mac.
Yeah.
And then it came with the game Tank, which was a two-player game.
God, Tank was so good.
And it was, and the great thing is that in those early years, the thing you would do is like I would play my sisters or whatnot, but then I would also play against myself and like try and use both controllers. I'd tape them down
you
to
Bobby
the table.
Fischered it.
And just try and just shoot the crap out of my other player and go, I'm black, I win. I'm white, I win. And that's kind of sad that that was the two colors that you had the choice of. But the graphics, oh, geez. I repaired my joystick so many times, like go grab a Phillips head and take it apart. And it would always be like one diode that was just missing. And you'd have to like put it back on and go back to town.
One thing I remember about those games was how evocative the box art was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you sit and play the game and the game is nothing like the box art, but you don't care.
No.
You saw the box art.
And that's why you
play the game and you are imagining all of this happening, such as Adventure, I think it was called, where your character is literally just a dot on the screen that you move around this terribly drawn pixelated labyrinth. But the box art has like this knight with a sword and a bow, and there's all monsters around, and literally it's just a dot and you're trying to avoid other dots, but you don't care because at the time that was what it was, and it was like the pinnacle of digital entertainment. Your brain just filled in all the gaps.
That's totally what it was in those days too, was you were making something move on the screen. Like you would watch television and Gilligan's Island, but you didn't get to control those characters. So suddenly you were controlling characters. The backlash of that for me was when the year after I got my Atari 2600, my mom bought me Space Invaders, and I'd been playing Space Invaders in the arcade, and I saw the box, and then when I took it out and plugged it in, I was like, this is terrible. It's not as good. And it's same with Asteroids. You got used to playing Asteroids and vector graphics, and suddenly you're in this pixelated universe. And you could do a few things, but just not the same.
I felt the same with a number of games in the Nintendo. Walmart near my house growing up had an arcade version, or had the arcade game Willow based on the movie. And it was this action, fast paced side scroller, kind of really cool thing. And it, for me, it had the best fucking graphics I'd ever seen ever. So then I had a Nintendo Entertainment System and I learned that there was a Willow game. So it's like, mom, I need Willow. Mom, I need Willow. Mama, we need Willow. And she bought it for me. And it was fucking nothing like it. It was nothing at all like the arcade game that I wanted. It was some wannabe Zelda clone. And I was like, fuck this game. I played it for about 10 minutes and then never touched it again.
Oh.
Yep.
There went all of your allowance money.
Jacob, what about you? You're sitting over here silent.
Well, part of it is that we didn't ever have consoles in my house. It was just a combination of way too poor for that and too busy, you know. Growing up rural, I mean, that was cutting into chore time, and you know,
lawn's not gonna mow itself. Jacob,
or the driveway shovel itself. Mile long driveway. We never owned a snowplow.
Oh god.
Yeah. I milked a cow and played video games as a kid. but I had a cow, so I have nothing to complain about.
So yeah, I didn't play much in the way of console games. You know, I think the first games I played were off the Apple IIe that we bought secondhand when I was like in early high school.
Hard Hat Mac?
You know, no. I think it was, well, I mean, we played the hell out of the Oregon Trail.
Oh, yeah, I did. On that Mac.
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much of that.
I played consoles a little bit when I went over to my friend's house, but even then it was not much of anything. I remember vaguely a bunch of Atari games that generally were really bad. I remember playing the hell out of Pitfall.
We had Pitfall. That game was amazing.
But Pitfall, as just a juncture point, was a Activision game, and it was like the first of third-party games made for the Atari system, which pretty much changed the future of video gaming. you know, the laid the pavework for EA and various other game manufacturers that are not Sony or Xbox.
Right. It basically allowed the existence of the game studio.
And Pitfall literally was a game changer, too. I was in ninth grade, went to a party. People just sat around the TV watching Pitfall because the graphics were so good.
But it was also a really tense game. Mm-hmm. It was a timing-based game, and it's the kind of game that if you're going to get the high score in Pitfall, as soon as the game begins, you have to do certain things in a certain pattern at a certain time, and you cannot stop moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and it might have been the first game that actually scrolled, you know, where you got off one screen. And not just a level was one screen like Frenzy or any number of arcade games. It actually, you were running and suddenly you were in another room or another section of the jungle.
And the other side effect was that because many of my friends had consoles at home, when I came over, the last thing they wanted to do was play the console. And that's part of the reason why I started getting into gaming so early as far as role-playing and board games, because they finally had someone around to do these interactive things with. I will say that when it came to early gaming, a good friend of mine's dad got the family an Amiga in the early 80s. I mean, direct from Europe. Like, the instructions were in French. And we played the hell out of the original Ultima series, which was pretty much as close to my start as it came. Other than that, it was like the arcade when we went into town.
I mean, I think I'm a little bit younger than the rest of this table here. So my first console that I was able to actually purchase that was relevant was the NES. And that was the only one that I think I ever owned. As far as consoles are concerned, I went PC gamer after that. But I remember having there's the Hunt for Red October game that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
That you just kind of shot things up or you shot them forward. And it didn't make any sense according to the game because I watched the movie so many times. And then the game was basically you're a submarine and you're trying not to get hit by things.
We are actually at that era now where the NES is also considered retro gaming. It's old enough to be retro.
I think even those considered. Yeah.
Even the Sega Genesis is, which is a fantastic. I have a Sega at home, in storage.
I got an email forwarded to me by a friend back home, and at the Minneapolis Retro Gaming Expo, one of the things they claim is it's all about retro gaming. PlayStation 1 and before.
Oh, God. But speaking of gaming expos, Portland has a very popular one called the Portland Retro Gaming Expo. It is coming up in October of this year. You can look it up online. They've been going for a few years now. I went to a couple. They're kind of cool. There's a few vendors, but it's mostly people bring their old consoles and set them up, and you can hang out and play. It's actually really awesome. They have some really rare old consoles that you had probably never knew existed.
The Neo Geo?
I think everybody knew the Neo Geo existed. Neo Geo's in that era that is hard for me to call retro. Well, like hearing the Sega Genesis called retro kind of hurts. Renting games for that and being, I'm not ready to I'm not ready to go there yet. Nope. Nope.
Echo the Dolphin.
God, I played the shit out of Echo.
That was one of my favorites. I love the Spider-Man one, too. But
one of the games that I played the most of on my Genesis was one of the first Naughty Dog games. It's called Rings of Power. Now, Naughty Dog, you might know from the Uncharted series now, the Last of Us. They're very, very popular, and I think they're a Sony exclusive currently publisher. But they made this role-playing game for the Sega Genesis called Rings of Power. It is, to date, one of the most epic games ever made. It's amazing. I still have the music stuck in my head. And if you have two controllers, there's a code that you can put in at the very beginning of the game to see a topless woman. I was a tween, so that was the thing for me.
Oh, goodness. That actually reminds me of something that I brought up with Xander, which was naughty gaming in the old days. And
oh, that's a whole subject.
Pixelated porn games.
Yeah. So they're... I do not condone this game in any way, but
I know in the 70s, what you're about to say.
There was a game called Custer's Revenge.
Custer's.
Oh,
yeah.
And it was,
I never played it.
I saw the graphics, but only because I did a search on it in the future, because I was like, did this actually exist or was this a childhood memory gone wrong? But I did read about it in People Magazine or Us or one of those things that were sitting around in my sister's room. And it was a truly, truly offensive game, but not because of the graphics were terrible. I mean, it was an Atari game, third party, but because of what you were supposed to do, which is basically kill native people. And then you're rewarded with a horrible sexual assault.
Well, so yeah. I've played it, and let me tell you how it... You know what? No, actually, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to stop myself. It's a terrible, horrible, racist game. It actually exists. My exposure to it was when I was in my 20s. I lived at a house full of nerds, and one of them had programmed a computer in the living room of this house to be connected to a MAME console built into it with... pretty much every old Atari, all the old school games ever at that time.
Yep.
And he had it set up so that you could not control what game you're about to play. All you did was press a button and it randomly loaded up a different game. And the only way to get to the next one was to play the first one and get to a point or for a few minutes or die. Anyway, I don't know how he did it. So we were randomly doing it. We're all sitting around and it randomly pops up. Custer's Revenge. And we're like, what is this? Die. And that was my exposure to that game. And it's terrible. I do not recommend looking up. But what I do recommend is checking out Ground Control here in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, yes.
It is a retro-themed arcade. It literally, when you walk into it, you feel like you're walking into the arcade for the movie Tron. It is
Flynn's
Arcade. Yeah, it is full of old arcade games and new ones, but a lot of old ones that you might remember from your youth.
Until recently, Tron.
And they had Tron?
Of Tron. They did have Tron for quite a while before they moved to the new location.
I've actually gone there recently, and it reminded me nothing of what it was when I used to go there. It seemed like it was mostly new school arcade games now. There were, it was very Tron-like. There's lots of crazy glowing lights everywhere. But the emphasis on retro gaming there seems to have been at least slightly diminished, at least during their remodel. They're going to open up a back room again, and I think that's where they're going to put all the retro games. But at least right now, it's like the moneymakers. It's a little bit disappointing to me.
Well, they expanded, so now they have to pay basically triple the rent, right?
But they're also not open to their full space yet. And my hope is that once they do, they will put all of that back. And what's funny is that somewhere in my collection of weird shit that I collected since I moved to Portland is a really old advertisement that I got from Ground Control. I think it was a postcard they sent out. And if you go to Ground Control, they will give you 4 free quarters to play games there.
whole dollar.
Has anyone at this table been to Quarter World yet?
Thank you, because that's what I was going to go there next. Quarter World is awesome, and they have good food and good drinks, and they have a lot of retro games. They have Golden Axe. They have
Golden Axe is so fun.
And they have a lot of those old arcade games that I pumped way too many quarters in when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember Gauntlet being like one of the newfangled games that I just couldn't get my head around.
Really?
Well, yeah, because I mean, I grew up on Donkey Kong, and I'm still like one of the best Donkey Kong Jr. players, but not so much Donkey Kong, but Donkey Kong Jr., Joust, and Robotron. Robotron is probably one of my favorite games.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was actually thinking about this earlier, about that game specifically, when you were talking about the hours that you spent playing Pong, because Robotron, my first exposure to that was as I wasn't even 10 yet. We were staying out of town somewhere. We were at a hotel, and in the basement with the laundry was a Robotron machine with infinite plays. just there for the kids at this hotel in the middle of bunk buck nowhere. I'm playing this Robotron. If I remember correctly, it was Robotron. It's where you have the little dude in the middle and you're being
saving
swarmed.
A family from.
You're basically being swarmed from all sides and you can shoot in all directions.
Eight directions, yeah. two controllers, two one stick. For direction and one yeah. for fire. And that's all you needed. But oh my goodness. But the Brainatrons, the Hulkatrons. The little drones.
We were at that tanks. Hotel for, it was Disney. It was somewhere in Disney World. We were staying at a hotel near Disney World. And I remember playing this Robotron game. I didn't even give a shit about Disney World anymore.
You know, saying that you're good at Joust is a bold claim, sir.
Oh,
I was good at Joust as a teenager. I am not good at Joust anymore, but I racked up some all-time highs back in 1985.
Well, in that case, since you and I are...
five.
Since
I was
you and
born.
I was 17.
Since you and I are a lot closer in age than these two, perhaps we need to find a joust machine and...
What I can't remember is if you play blue, can you still play right-handed? Like,
yes.
They have buttons on both sides, yes. Right? Okay.
What I recommend you do sometime, Skip, is head to Ground Control now, and they have a game which is like a modern-day upgrade of Joust, and it is a team competitive game. Cannot remember the name of this game for the life of me. It's like Save the Queen or the Queen something. Anyway, your team has different types of characters that can do different things, but it is essentially competitive team Joust with a modern retro-themed interface.
Oh, sounds fun.
Yeah.
I declare field trip.
Let's make it happen.
Let's make it happen.
Listeners, find us sometime at Ground Control or Quarter World and challenge us to a game. Or play some Golden Axe with me.
Or Wonderland. My
favorite game ever. Quarter World.
What about Wonderland? I haven't been there in a long time.
But then you have to deal with kids.
That's fair.
But you get to play with nickels.
That's also, but they up the price so that yeah. you might as well not be playing with nickels. Anyway, blah, blah, grumpy, grumpy, grumpy.
Best arcade game of all time still is Streets of Rage.
I can drink to that. To Streets of Rage. And to retro gaming
and
in general.
Retro gaming
in
general. Hey. What we're going to be talking about now is the Handy Slut. I mean, the Sandy Hut. Sorry, I got confused again.
No, you didn't.
So the Sandy Hut is one of the older continuously operating bars in town. I believe it was built in the 1920s, I want to say. It's been under a couple iterations, obviously, since then. But most notably recently is when we got the sad news that it was going to shut down. And then some folks that own some other bars in town saved it, which was really nice. But it's different today.
Now, not to be confused with the Sandy Jug.
No.
Which we might talk about at some point in the future.
The Sandy Hut is located on approximately Sandy and 12th-ish? 14th?
That's right where Sandy splits off from Burnside.
Yeah, so that's like 14th, I think. It's a weird triangle-shaped building.
And that whole area is just...
clusterfuck?
Different now.
Oh, yeah.
You used to be able to like stand where the Sandy Hut is and see the sky. And now it's getting harder and harder to see the sky with all of the developments building up around it.
They tore down an amazing old funeral home.
Yes, they did.
An amazing young mortician.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Who resembled Morticia from the Addams Family, who used to come into the Sandy Hut.
And linking it, you know, back to our overall theme, the Sandy Hut, if you were standing in front of the front door of the Sandy Hut, you were within 6 blocks of 2 different motorcycle shops down the street from Doc Brown's over on 16th and the Sang Frond season opener was started at the Sandy Hut for years. And so it was a hub of, it was a stop on the Thursday night motorcycle ride for years. And it was a part of the motorcycle community for a long time.
In fact, one of the bands that I play in, the Portland Cello Project, once played in the Sandy Hut at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning for the spring ride.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Unbelievable. It was during the smoking years, too.
Were you in that show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did you feel playing a show at 7 a.m. at the Sandy Hut?
It was really hard because I probably left there at 2:45 the morning before. I spent a lot of time at the Sandy Hut between 2002 and 2010.
Well, I mean, I like the Sandy Hut too, because that it was one of those bars where, I mean, last call in the state of Oregon is basically usually 15 minutes before 2:30, because they want you to finish up by 2:30 so they can kick you out. Sandy Hut was one of the few bars where if at 2:29 you bought that last like beer and shot, they would just lock the door and you could just finish it there because they didn't give a shit. Like it was fine with them.
Fantastic place for a long time. I spent many Christmases there after my divorce.
I must admit, I have lived in this town now for 14 years. I did not go to the Sandy Hut for the first time until 2 months ago.
Oh, really?
It was always something that I forgot about. And then I was like, oh, the Sandy Hut, that's where it is, as I'm riding home from work.
Sure.
And already moving past it. And then I forget about it again because I have other bars that I prefer. So I was never exposed to the Sandy Hut until about 2 months ago. Met a friend there for happy hour drinks. And the bar was chaos.
Yep.
Getting a drink was a pain in the ass. And the music was loud. But it was a beautiful English bulldog there that came and sat with me, and it was awesome. Oh, so
that is fantastic.
That was my one and only experience at the Sandy Hut. It was an English bulldog. It was good.
So you know that those weird glass blocks at the end of the bar that all the light kind of comes through?
Yeah, yeah.
So in our time, it was so covered in, probably just decades of cigarette smoke and vomit and all these other things.
And fluids.
That you couldn't see through them. I didn't actually realize those were glass blocks until they cleaned that place up.
It's actually because they were painted over and paneled over.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that's where they put all the poker machines in the old days. But they had a shuffleboard table against the other wall. But
I remember
they
that.
Had paneling over the
glass Okay, that makes blocks. More sense. Because I never knew they were there was the point of my story. Because yeah. You can see them from the outside, right?
You could see, but they were painted purple or something.
Okay. Yeah, I just remember they weren't there, then they were. And all of a sudden, all this light came into the bar, and I was very confused.
It was very confusing.
When I moved into Portland back in 2007, I was living on 15th and Stark. So the Sandy Hut was one of the closest bars.
Yes.
And I drank there pretty regularly. It probably was the first bar I was ever in. And then ever since then, I've been in and out of there as either a customer or on a professional basis numerous times. I've had to give testimony to police officers about activities I saw in front of there.
That sounds about right.
I've had to pull out my crash bag to do medic work out there.
Yes, I was once in there during the daytime before it was light. You couldn't tell whether you were in there during the day or night back in the day. And there were probably only 6 or 7 people in. And a guy ran in and ran over to the Mega Touch machine and quickly went out the side. And about 3 minutes later, cops came in and they found a paper bag with a gun in it next to the machine. And completely they chased him down.
Oh, but my God.
I had had so many experiences there. The last several podcasts where you were talking about bars with smoke, I was a smoker back in those days. And,
me too.
And there were times when I'd walk through the front door, take a breath and gag and have to go back outside and breathe really deeply to get oxygenated enough to walk in.
I felt that about most smoking bars in Portland as a smoker. Yeah.
Yeah. It was intense.
Portlanders love to smoke.
I should have worn it today, but I still have a handy slut t-shirt that
yeah, they don't make those anymore,
from way back when, and it just had on the corner, it said on the, you know, where the left pocket would be, it said Sandy Hut hangovers installed and serviced. And on the back it had the Miller High Life red icon, and yeah, it said welcome to the low life. And then Miller said no.
I want to tangent onto something that you just said that was actually mentioned as we were planning this episode, and that is, you said about back in the day. Now, I have very little familiarity with the Sandy Hut other than it being a waypoint on my daily commute, but I understand that there was a back in the day versus a now.
Quite a few.
What's the story there?
So the general story was that I believe the Sandy Hut was supposed to shut down.
I don't remember it being about to shut down. But
it changed ownership.
It changed ownership. And I would say that the Sandy Hut has many, many lives. My good friend's grandparents went into that bar in the 50s, and they turned her grandfather away for not having a tie.
The Sandy Hut.
Back in the 50s.
And they have this brilliant Al Hirschfeld drawing that's still there. That's the only one outside of L.A.
Yeah.
That's got like all the stars from the, you know, yesteryear. Edward G. Robinson and Marilyn and the Marx Brothers.
Again, another thing.
It's a big diner scene, and it's about like 12 feet by 8 feet high. And it's still in there. Once they stopped smoking, that was the end of the early era that I played in. And then they started having punk bands in there. The Dwarfs played there.
Whoa, really? Yes.
Yeah.
And I love the Dwarfs.
And I stopped going during that period of time. And then the Gold Dust Meridian people
bought it from
the owner.
Right. Okay.
The thing with that mural that Skip is talking about is that's another thing I did not know existed in that bar until the owners bought it and cleaned that place up, the new owners, because it was hidden. And all of a sudden, this rare, unusual, gorgeous, awesome mural just popped out. And they're like, oh, wait, this is real. This is the thing that was lost for a long time. And no one knew it was there because the previous owners had boarded it up.
Yeah, I mean, the Sandy Hut has a lengthy legacy going back to just after Prohibition in this town. It was one of the places that was open where you could buy beer or wine, but if you wanted hard liquor, you had to bring your own bottle and turn it over to the bartender, and then they would pour for you.
Those laws still exist today, by the way.
Yeah, they do, but
no one knows about them or abides by them.
Yeah.
There are a few places in town where you can do that.
Oh, really? Oh.
Well, there are a few that advertise that, but not many.
But it used to be you could not walk into a bar in this town except private clubs and get hard liquor.
That's mind-boggling.
I fear for the Sandy Hut's future
because of
its location.
It's numbered.
It's something that we've talked about before, which is this tendency of people who want to move into a neighborhood that they like, that's happening, that's popular. Oh, we're going to live close to our favorite bar. Now we're going to have kids. And now we're going to complain that the bar is open too late and making noise. And then we're going to get that bar shut down because, well, we're more important than that place that we move next to be close to.
Right.
And I'm afraid that the Sandy Hut is going to be that kind of place. Like these condos that are moving up right next to it, that are in the construction right now.
Right.
People are going to be like, oh, yeah, I want to move where all this area, it's all happening here. Well, things are happening too late. I'm going to get them shut down.
Right.
It could happen. I actually passed the Slammer the other day and thought, it's going to be a sad day when this place closes. And then I turned the corner by the monstrosity that used to be the funeral home and is now becoming more housing next to the Sandy Hut. And I thought, wow, that's some prime real estate. And I remember telling the former owner, John, like 10 years ago, you need to build a rooftop bar on this place. Like, because it's that perfect triangle. It would be great for a rooftop bar.
Oh, it would be wonderful.
But I'm sure, you know, like that's easy for for the drunk guy in there. yeah.
What, just a small side note on that. When you look at places like the Slammer, which we'll have to do an episode on, and the Sandy Hut, I mean, they are at risk, but they're also going to be some of the last to go because they are on those weird shaped lots.
I think they're both on that shirt Linsel was talking about too. Yeah. They just haven't been crossed through yet.
Yeah, it's until they can figure out how to rezone and change right of ways on some of the streets so they can redevelop those properties into a slightly larger footprint that's a little bit more regular, they're relatively safe.
One can hope.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also really love the Sandy Hut, too, because it was always the second stop on my somewhat annual Petapalooza Tom Waits Broken Bicycles ride.
Oh,
because they were always really cool about us going there. The first was over at Billy Ray's Dive Bar, because anyone would just lock up their bikes to, like, the giant chain link fence outside. And then Sandy Hut had a decent amount of bike parking outside. That was always our second stop, and they were always really cool about it. And so we would just bring a bunch of, like, drunken Tom Waits fans in there. We would just, like, flood the jukebox. And then it was weird that first year when all the light came through in the at like 5 p.m. because all of a sudden they'd cleaned out the glass.
And just to jump back a little bit, that Hirschfeld mural was always there, but it was behind a thick smoke-covered piece of plastic and a golden tea machine that was right in front of it.
That makes way more sense.
who was this artist? I don't know this artist.
If you can imagine, like, New Yorker, like, kind of like the
caricatures,
the Venice Beach, like, caricature artists where they, yeah, like,
but really picture. Good.
What he did was he did, like, Hollywood in a supper club, but he would put every star in it and in that sort of caricaturized way. So, like, you know, Edward G. Robinson had extra big eyebrows and lips and jowls, and you know, the Marx Brothers looked like cartoon versions of themselves down the table from the Three Stooges.
Oh, okay.
So very flowing lines, yeah. Really wonderfully.
A lot of movement.
Yeah, a lot of movement.
Is that the art that's outside?
Inside.
What's the art that's outside?
I haven't been there for a while, but
it's bad.
At somewhere around 2010 or 11, they gave it a facelift. It used to be kind of this sort of burnt brick colored red on the outside and yellow like the sign.
I remember that, yeah.
And then somebody came in, I think one of the bartenders kind of headed it, and they did that sort of like elementary school mural thing with Sesame Street characters and drunks.
Like on I think there's like a Popeye character out there.
There's a Howlin' Wolf for a while, yeah, wasn't there?
Oh, Howlin' Wolf.
I don't remember. Oh, okay. Well, I know it's called the part where the ice or the glass blocks are is called the Wolf's Den.
Yeah, because there used to be a Howlin' Wolf out there, I thought, painted on the building.
Probably. Sense. Yeah, it's
again, I was inebriated a lot when I was there.
Me too. When I first started going there, well, vodka tonics were $2.75. And they served Baron von Rothschild vodka.
I see. You and I have very similar drinking habits.
Last time and only time I was there, I ordered Old Granddad, and it was like $4. It was pretty good.
It's not bad.
Not bad at all.
No, that's still a good price. That's like dive bar price. Yeah, it's a dive bar still.
And yeah. That's the thing. It truly was a dive bar in the old days. And I know we've talked about dive bars that are less dive bar-y. I worried about that because, you know, Gold Dust Meridian is a kind of a fancy little place to get a meal and a cocktail on Hawthorne.
Good happy hour there. Yeah, amazing happy hour.
Fabulous owners. And they bought the dearly departed Club 21.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
And then they bought the Sandy Hut. And I was kind of worried that they were going to make the Sandy Hut something other than it is. And it still is the Sandy Hut. I think I've just grown and moved away from it. But their menu's good.
Don't they also own the Steinhaus out on 82nd? Used to be a strip club called Assets. It's at the corner of 82nd and Division, right across from PCC. I think that's the Gold Dust people.
That might be, but yeah. That's currently closed.
The Steinhaus is closed.
What?
Yeah.
What? Oh, they had one of the best selections of beer. It's closed?
It's getting torn down.
Yeah.
It should be taboo.
I will say for the Sandy Hut is that when the people from Gold Dust did buy it and they did remodel their food menu, they actually basically brought it back to their 1950s menu, which is like Crab Louie and like a bunch of other stuff like that. That they don't really have at bars anymore, but they basically just modeled it after the 1950s menu. So that, I thought that was really cool.
I can't imagine ever eating food there.
Oh, ever. For the St. Franc season opener, I ate a lot of greasy breakfasts there.
Okay, and how quickly did those greasy breakfasts say hello a second time?
Not at all.
I've got to say, again, back in the day, during crab season or clam season, you could go in and buy a pound of steamer clams for $4.95, $5.95.
Holy cow.
And then you could get 2 pounds of steamer clams for $6.95, and you could get 5 pounds of steamer clams for $9.95. And they were good, and they brought you drawn butter and Texas toast, and I ate so many clams there, and I never had intestinal distress from it. Like, but I also knew many of the cooks and all of the bartenders. I felt like Norm when I went in there back in the day.
I was drinking at another bar. It's also of the dive variety. And was talking with two old-timers that said that they were in an argument between whether it was Sandy Hut or another place where back in the 1960s, you could go in during a certain time of year for the buck and shuck. You paid a dollar and you shucked clams and oysters and you got like for every three you shucked, you got one.
That's awesome. I would do that.
Well, let's raise a toast to the Sandy Hut shucking oysters. May the old Sandy Hut
never
remain
die.
The new Sandy Hut for as long as it possibly can.
The hut will rise again.
Unganganja, unga solo.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
So I was listening to your episode a few weeks ago when you had Linzel from the Tugboat on, and the Tugboat is the first place that I played music in back in 1994. I think it was October. When I booked the gig, it actually was called the Norwester Pub, and but Megan hired me to come and play there. And at the time, you could play whatever you wanted. There was no, like, it needs to be non-copyrighted jazz or original music. It was just a thing. So I went in there to play with a friend, and it was one of those wonderful, muggy, early October nights where it was spritzing rain, but it's just kind of humid. So they had an air conditioner on right over the door, as they do. And my friend and I were called What You Gonna Duo. And we were playing our duo songs when suddenly we couldn't breathe. And neither could anybody else in the bar because somebody underneath the front door had a knife pulled on them. And he pulled out a can of pepper spray and sprayed it at the guy with the knife. And it came through the little window air conditioning unit over the door and was diffuse enough that it wasn't like, you know, pepper spray in your eyes, but it was in our lungs. And so everybody's coughing and just pouring out the front door.
And nobody's yelling, boo.
Right. And but to me and my friend Kirk, we were like, oh my God, the place was packed and they were loving what we were doing. Like, so I was like, oh, it's kind of raining out here. People are leaving. What are we going to do? And I was like, a few minutes went by and I went back inside and took a deep breath and realized that it was gone. You know, they had opened the door. I was like, how do I get people back in here? So I went up to the stage and I pulled out a guitar and I played Breathe by Pink Floyd.
Well done, sir. Well done.
The show only lasted another 25 minutes because some underage people were packing Rainier Pounders and caught by the bartender whose name escapes me at this point. But, yeah, they were, he was like, that's it. The show's over. And I went a week or so before it closed too, but I many times between 1994 and the closure.
To the tugboat.
And the Sandy Hut.
To the Sandy Hut.
And hopefully it will, you know, keep going. Well, Skip, it's actually been quite a pleasure having you here with us today. I'm glad to finally get to meet you. I did yell at you once outside Dante's, but you had no idea who I was.
My current dive bar. / world-class music venue.
Yeah. So what do you do currently? Do you have any shows coming up or in the next week or more?
In fact, I do. I'll be at the Three Rivers Casino this weekend. So you'll have missed it if you're listening to this on Sunday night or Monday. But I play every Monday night at Edgefield Winery in the winery hallway and have been doing that since 2005. I have different guest artists with me all the time. I play happy hours at Dante's on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I play with the Portland Cello Project all over the country and used to play with Vagabond Opera all over the world. But that's not current. So I play under the name Cellotronic as a solo artist. I play in a duo called Groovy Wallpaper that is
so good,
working on a new album. And occasionally I write opening title, theme songs for various podcasts and I soundtrack horror movies.
I have a question for you about the Vagabond Opera. Why does the Vagabond Opera no longer play? And it's a two-part question. Because, part two, when will we get another Day of the Dead party? Because my partner and I, that was like our biggest thing of the year, was going to that show at the Star Theater with Vagabond Opera and Trivona.
Those were the days, weren't they?
They were amazing. We were always first in line.
They were.
Fantastic.
We showed up like an hour and a half before and got first in line. Except once, when one person was before us, and God damn it, their costumes were amazing and they deserved it.
Were you ever on stage for the costume contest?
No, we were not.
That's okay. Yeah. Number one, Vagabond Opera is, I like to think, and I think most of us like to think, that we're just currently in hiatus. You know, it's not over until we pass. and probably it's never over because we've been digitally captured, several albums, a couple of which I produced. We're all still friends. We all care about each other, and hopefully it will happen again. It would be fantastic if it happened around Day of the Dead, but I can't tell you because I can't see to the future.
So you mentioned you do music for horror movies?
I do.
Oh, what are some of the movies we can hear your work in?
Well, there's a movie called Hours Till Daylight by a fantastic local filmmaker named John Garcia.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar.
Who also made a couple of films about love in the Mormon faith.
Yeah, I'm familiar also, with those two.
Are those also horror movies?
if you're up in the Mormon church, perhaps.
I saw Jesus Camp. That was a horror movie.
He's just made a number of wonderful small films. Hours Till Daylight, I believe, you can get it on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
And it's a really, a horror movie is like a little simplifying it. It's a suspense thriller.
Yeah, no. I recently watched this like a month ago on Amazon Prime, and it was amazing. And I loved the soundtrack. I am just kind of stoked to find out that was yours.
Well, I'll be honest. John is an amazing songwriter and musician himself. So a lot of the soundtrack is what he. I think there's some of his music in it. And some library music that he licensed, but a lot of the creepy
the
groaning strings and atmospherics. That's me, and I can get you a copy of that if.
We'll
talk about it off air.
Yes,
but I did another movie with a director named Daniel Eidenstead, who's at the Twin Peaks Festival right now, and it stars Eric Roberts and a handful of other people, but it's called The Creeping Darkness. It's been a little while since I've done this movie, but I work with a studio engineer named John Neff, who was in Blue Bob with David Lynch and was David Lynch's sound design guy for many years. I'm currently working on a new Groovy Wallpaper album with him, and he's in Portland as well.
Awesome.
Awesome. Well, listeners, that's how you can see Skip live or find other things that he's done. Skip, thanks again for hanging out with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And Skip, if people want to find you online, how do they find you?
Well, cellotronic.com is my website, which is CELLOTRONIK, because I like to keep things simple. if you go to skipvonkusky.com, it'll take you to a Japanese eyebrow hair removal site. I've licensed my name to them by forgetting to renew my domain. Some 5 years ago. you can find me on Facebook as well, and Skip Von Kusky Music or Cellotronic or Groovy Wallpaper. And I'm out there in the ether.
Folks, if you haven't heard Skip beyond our intro and outro, find one of these many ways to hear him and put him in your ears.
So good.
Thank you, Spotify.
Well, thanks again for listening, folks. As usual, I'm Nathaniel.
I'm just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And once again, joining us today is our special guest,
Skip Von Kusky.
And as always, we want to encourage you.
Keep a rubber side down.
May your dice always roll crits.
Always tip your bartender.
Always have another one for me.
Excellent. And hey, Skip, how about you play us out?
Thanks for joining us, friends.
We of bikers, dice, and bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. But bikes, games, dice, and bars.
Yep.